This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Hindu Studies podcast, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. Today, I get to speak with Dr. Michael Sluber, who's associate professor at Western Washington University. And we're talking about a really, really rich, exciting, fascinating new volume called A Garland of Forgotten Goddesses, Tales of the Feminine Divine from India and Beyond, hot off the presses in 2020. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So this is brand new. I was reading your preface. I was astonished at the date. It's dated actually today's date, September 30th, 2020. I had this surreal moment. I'm like, wow, timely.
Yeah.
We didn't plan that, but you know, the stars have aligned, it seems.
Yeah, it won't officially be released, available to buy until December, but it's coming soon.
Coming soon. So get excited, and I'm sure people can pre-order it if they so desire.
Yes.
Now, what is the Garland of Forgotten Goddesses all about? What's the overarching theme that unites these papers?
Sure. So, one thing I want to make really clear at the beginning is it's different than other edited volumes. So it's not like a collection of research papers so much as it is an anthology of primary sources. And so that's something that reviewers, when I was trying to get this book published, I was having a hard time kind of conveying to reviewers because it's something totally new. In the field of goddess studies, we don't have a volume like this that is introducing different goddess traditions from different parts of India and other places through narratives. And so, it's different than just another volume of edited primary or edited contributions to scholarship. It's really meant as a tool for general readers or for teaching.
So that itself is fascinating, and it's great. It's a collection of these really rich stories from various parts of India about various goddesses. And, you know, I'm slightly biased considering my scholarship is centered around narratives of goddesses, but I'm sure that there are many out there who would just love the accessibility of these narratives, which prior to this anthology really wouldn't be accessible unless one was conversant in their in the native tongue and were able to read manuscripts. Is that
right?
Is that fair?
Right. That's the case with quite a few of the sources. None of them were available in English before, but some of them weren't even available in printed editions. So some of them were only accessible through manuscripts until this book. So yeah, that makes it quite exciting. It's original new material. So that's one of the big points of the book.
So it's an anthology of primary source narratives about forgotten goddesses. forgotten how or by whom?
Right. So that's something I explain kind of carefully, because it's possible to misinterpret that. Some of the goddesses are absolutely not forgotten. We have a chapter on Kameshwari, which is another name for Tripura Sundari. And so she, for example, has millions of active followers in India and other places. And so we use the term forgotten in different senses, depending on which chapter and which goddess that we're talking about. Some of them are absolutely forgotten, and most people would never have heard of them, despite their stories being really fascinating. But others, like Tripura Sundari, are very much part of living traditions, but the sources that we're translating are unique, and they're among the earliest that exist, and they're sources that people just haven't heard of before, because not very many people are reading manuscripts.
Tell us maybe a little bit about the structure of the anthology. There are three sections, for example. How are the papers grouped?
Sure. So the three sections are dividing into demons and battle. So it's kind of by theme of the stories themselves. So the first four are about goddesses fighting demons, which is typically the case in a lot of these narratives. In some of the other, so the second section is miracles and devotees. We also get mentions of battle in these chapters, but it really takes a backseat to stories of how the devotees interact with the goddess and different miracles that the goddesses perform for the devotees. So I've also organized the papers in the volume based on accessibility, so that the easier to read and grasp stories are closer to the beginning. And then it gets slightly more complicated as we come to the third and last section, which is tantras and magic. Some of these sources are pure narratives, but a couple of the last ones are translations directly from tantric ritual texts, which are describing how to visualize the goddess, or sort of presenting a mystical position on the nature of the goddess, as is the case in the final chapter.
Do you want to say a little bit about this tension of... maybe we'll do them separately, but first, regional and transregional. I want to say a little bit about that. That's really important to this volume, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. So that's definitely important. There's an interplay that we can see embedded in these texts of local identities that change as the goddess becomes very popular, and as the goddess's identity gets sort of hitched or yoked, linked with the identity of a more pan-Indian goddess, or certain elements of a pan-Indian story, like the Devi Mahatmya, come to have a very essential role in the local narratives. And so the ways that these two sort of identities get meshed is on display throughout the book. And it influences the trajectory of the goddess's development. So, she might start, one example I give is chapter two, these two goddesses from Mysuru in South India. They start out as Grama Devata. They are protectors of a local place. They're identified with the hills near the city of Mysore. But then, through this interconnections with the narrative of the slaying of the buffalo demon, most famous through the Devi Mahatmya, the goddess Chamundi, the principal goddess of these two sisters, comes to be presented more like Durga. So her name is Chamundi, and this sounds very much like a fearsome Kali-like goddess, but that dimension of her identity, assuming that it was there, we don't have records that it was there, but judging by her name, that local aspect of her identity was kind of erased as she is presented to the larger audience of pilgrims from all over India that want to come to the very place where the goddess is supposed to have fought with the buffalo demon and killed him. And then interestingly in that chapter, her sister takes on all the qualities of Durga. So her sister is named Uttanahalli, and she's from a village nearby. And she takes on all the fearsome qualities, and she does some of the fighting. And so, it's kind of like, you know, even though on the one hand, Hindus believe that all the goddesses are one and, you know, there's no difference between Kali and Durga, for example, there's still a power behind these separate identities that we can see because there was a need to shift from Chamundi to make her like Durga as we're, you know, it's being presented to a trans-regional audience.
So this is an absolutely fascinating tension. You're talking about a contribution by Caleb Simmons. Actually, a couple of the contributors have been on the program before. Jessica has as well. Yes. So for folks who are interested in these topics, there are other podcasts you can check out. It's fascinating, right? You have this goddess, this Grama Devata to Mysore called Chamundi, mm-hmm. and you have this narrative of her slaying the buffalo demon. So for those listening, would you say it's such that that was a local myth that was also folded into the Devi Mahatanyapan Indic myth of the Devi, or vice versa? Or how would you describe that relationship for people who may not quite grasp it?
Sure. I mean, we don't know for sure because what we have in the source that's translated is a modern story through a singing tradition from the Kamsale community in southern Karnataka. So we don't know exactly how far back these songs go. I think it's more likely that the story of killing the buffalo demon goes back far, far earlier, and that at some point in history, this goddess Chamundi was linked to that story. But we, you know, this is just a hypothetical description of what might have happened. We don't have records in this case of exactly how far back this story goes with Chamundi beyond like the 15th century. I mean, we have records of it going back that far, the association between Chamundi and the local king of Mysore. But beyond that, we don't have good evidence.
There are other examples in terms of entries in the anthology that that really play with this idea of regional and trans-regional, similar to the Chamundi. Do you want to cite some other examples?
Yeah, sure. Let me glance at my notes here to pick one. I mean, certainly it's there throughout almost all of them. But yeah, let's talk about the first chapter called Bhadrakali, Slaying the Demon in the Backwaters by Noor van Brussel, a scholar from Belgium. This story is a very interesting mix of influences. I mean, on the one hand, there's references to Bhadrakali or a goddess like Bhadrakali, Korava, I'm sure you're familiar with. Who goes all the way back to the classical Tamil story, Silapathikaram. And so that's part of the influence, but there's certainly influence from the Devi Mahatmya. There's certainly interconnections with the Devi Purana story of the seven mothers slaying the demon Ruru. So there's all these various interweaving connections that inform this sort of late medieval a local Purana from Kerala called the Bhadrakali Mahatmya. The goddess's identity is a patchwork, basically. It's very fascinating how the story comes together and how it's unique, in contrast to all the other influences. It's at once similar to stories that people will have heard from other places, but it's also very unique. For example, it has a lot of emphasis on the demon Darika, his backstory, sort of his sense of injustice at the gods mistreating his race, and you know, basically performing a genocide on all of his forefathers. And so he wants to get revenge on the gods. So the way the story is told really kind of makes the reader almost empathize with the demonic character, which is strange. It's not the typical narrative device. And then you get these goddesses, Bhadrakali herself, a fearsome goddess, but then she partners up with a goddess named Vaitali, normally means something like a female vampire. And this Vaitali is very bloodthirsty. So it's almost like the demons become the demons become humanized and the goddesses become demonized. So it's at once unique to the local place and rooted in performance traditions in Kerala, but at the same time, interwoven with more trans-regional themes and stories.
It's a really, really fascinating narrative. Now, just by chance, there's a special volume in Religions on violence and the goddess. And Noor ended up contributing a paper to that. And well, it's after the fact now, it's already published. So I guess I can mention that, you know, I ended up being one of the reviewers. And I was so fascinated by the content of the paper that when once it was already published, and I knew Noor from the conference circuit, I approached her and said, look, like there's, I mean, have you done a comparison of the Devi Mahatmya and this regional Kerala Bandanakali Mahatmya? And she's like, you know, you're like the seventh person that says I should do that. I'm like, well, why don't we do that? So we're actually in the process of eking out, it's delayed due to my writing schedule right now, but of eking out a comparison to show the extent to which the one draws from the other and the extent to which they're very different. But this idea of a sort of humanizing the demons. There's a scene that's so startling where the goddess Bhadrakali is, she's feeling compassion for Taruka. She doesn't want to kill him because he's begging for his life. And the gods basically say, like, don't be possessed by this demon compassion. You know, go get over yourself. Go. Don't let this demon of compassion, you know, sway you out of your dharma. And it's so fascinating, right?
Right.
Anyhow.
And that sort of thing comes up again in one of the other chapters. Let me see. I believe it was the chapter on Bahuchara from Gujarat. And she takes the form of a young girl, and there's this demon that's not totally evil. You know, he's almost vegetarian. That everyone's telling him because there's no food around, he should just drink the blood of animals, and he refuses to do that. And he's this devotee of the goddess. But then he says that he like is feigning sexual attraction to her in order to make her angry so that she will kill him so that he'll go to heaven, because anyone killed by the goddess will go straight to heaven. So we get this interesting relationship between them, and interesting way that they communicate.
Fascinating. Do you want to, you know, I don't necessarily want to put you on the spot, but do you want to make mention, just a brief mention of all of the contributions so we don't leave anyone else? I know we talked about Noor's paper and Caleb's paper, chapters 1 and 2.
Sure.
Maybe we'll do it systematically just to make sure that we don't leave anyone out.
Yeah, sure. So, those were chapters 1 and 2 in this first section on demons in battle. The third one is called Kaushiki, the Virgin Demon Slayer. And let's see. So, yeah, this one comes from Kashmir. There are some elements that readers will recognize from the Devi Mahatmya. But another major difference is that the goddess, like in this story that I mentioned about Bahuchara, she's presented as a young girl, in this case, an 8-year-old girl. So actually, if you wouldn't mind, I would like to read just a page and a half or so from this story.
Not only would I not mind that, I'd actually love that. I was going to suggest that we give some of the flavor, right? It's narrative. So please, by all means.
Okay. So I'm picking up in the middle of the story. So there's some background, but basically we've got these demons that can only be killed by a female. We have the goddess Kaushiki, also called Durga, but we're going with the name Kaushiki in this story. She's an 8-year-old girl living on the Vindhya Mountains alone. And so the gods, in order to get the demons to take interest in her, send Narada down, and he basically talks her up as this very beautiful jewel and the most beautiful, you know, woman in the world, even though she's a young girl. So, you know, it's this interesting tension about attraction toward a prepubescent girl, which the gods are absolutely not trying to encourage, but they're trying to get the demons to feel it so that they are, you know, going to be open to being killed by her. So that's kind of the background. The demons get interested after Narada tells them about her. They talk about, you know, how they should approach her, and they decide, well, she might get scared because she's just a little girl and we're a bunch of demons. So let's send the demon among us called Barbarian, Barbara. And, you know, he's kind of gently speaking. So this in itself is a strange description of a demon, but a very humanized kind of description. But he goes and he's, you know, some things happen. But basically now they're talking. He's talking to the goddess. So Barbarian, whose mind was completely deluded and whose body was tightly bound, he started speaking. the Lord of Demons, who has conquered all the gods, demons, and humans, and is now the ruler of the universe, has decided to choose you as his wife, O beautiful goddess. With due respect, a girl must be given in marriage, and where could one find a husband like him? So consider yourself to be honored to be his wife. That is what I suggest. When she heard him speak in this way, the charming goddess smiled gently, and with a brow slightly raised, spoke these sweet words. Indeed, a woman must have a husband, and a man must have a loving wife. Which woman would not desire such a handsome man who is also the richest in the world? All righteous men know, however, that only the father can give a daughter in marriage. She may also organize a marriage contest for herself, or alternately, she can be taken by force. So she's laying out these three options. I do not know who my father was, so who else could give me in marriage? And I have no notion of what is appropriate, so I cannot hold a marriage contest. Now, what else can I say? The Lord of Demons is powerful. If he takes a wife for himself by force, what else could be more appropriate? You should go and tell him about this, barbarian. I command you, Panchala, to release the ogres from the chains. After these words of the goddess, Panchala released them. Seeing them without the chains, Kaushiki spoke again. These ogres who have been produced from barbarian's body are my followers, called the barbarians. They are without the sins of greed and egotism. By looking at me, they have become valiant. These barbarians shall only think of me. Even those mortals who are born in their lineage shall obtain the highest good, since they will also be purified by their devotion to me. When Durga spoke in this way, all the ogres produced from barbarians' bodies started worshiping the mother of the three worlds with great devotion. In the meantime, barbarian, released by the great goddess, quickly went to see the demons who wished to possess her and said to them, I have seen that young and beautiful girl. Indeed, there's nothing comparable to her in the other worlds. She's the mother of the whole universe and shines forth with energy. Her servant, Panchala, is the powerful king of yakshas. After this speech, Barbarian explained what the goddess had told him, and the demons became totally blinded as they were heading toward their fate. We shall all go there, they said in their lust, and climbed up the Vindhya mountain by the pathways going upward. As their feet were stomping everywhere, the Vindhya was trembling like a tree hit by a storm. The gods, headed by Indra, honored Vishnu and went to the peak of the Vindhya, eager to see the fight. So, yeah, I'll stop there, so I'm not giving too much away, but we know that there's a big fight coming in. It's a very well-told story.
No need for spoiler alerts here. That's great. So what about the fourth one in the demons in battle?
Okay, the fourth one is The Seven Mothers, Origin Tales from Two Early Medieval Puranas by Shaman Hatley. And this includes the very earliest source that we translated in the volume. This is a passage from the original 6th century Skanda Purana, on the origin of the seven mothers. It's a very short one, only 2 pages, so I asked Dr. Hatley to include one other story as well. So we also translated part of the Devi Purana, which is a century or two later, not easily assigned to a date, that one. These two accounts are fairly different. What I find fascinating about them is that the first one gives a fairly standard, short explanation of the seven mothers being produced from the male Brahminical gods, Shiva, Vishnu, etc. Whereas the latter one, you know, sort of hints that that's the case, but then asserts that the goddesses ultimately come from the supreme divinity, which the Devi Purana identifies as the supreme Shakti. So it's definitely a more female-centered approach than the older Skanda Purana story.
You raise a really interesting point there that I believe you flesh out in your introduction. And so, in terms of the history of religion or comparative religion, you know, God as a she is something that may not be as well established as it is in India. But
this idea, mildly.
yeah. I'm currently teaching undergrads a survey religion course, and it just reminds me, it's allowing me to see Hinduism more clearly by teaching Abrahamic religions. But just because there are feminine faces, right? There's a feminine divine. This doesn't necessarily mean that the narratives are bereft of patriarchy, for example.
Correct.
So maybe say a quick note about that, because I think that's an interesting point to safeguard people from sort of thinking, well, you know, if we had more female goddesses, we'd have less patriarchy. It's not necessarily the case.
Right, not necessarily. Although you know, it's a very complex question. I also deal with this in my teaching, because many people come to the class. They want to learn about goddesses, and they think that this is going to be a resource for feminism, and sometimes it is, and in some ways it is absolutely. But in other ways, sort of the larger picture of not only India but pretty much the whole world is that almost every culture is patriarchal to some degree, and so we see that. We see that in the United States and Canada, obviously. We see that in India as well. So, you know, all of the stories have some kind of patriarchal stamp to them, but some more than others, and some resist that in interesting ways. So it's absolutely a mix.
So maybe you could tell us about the papers in part two, Miracles and Devotees.
Sure. So the first one is by Jessica Van Tien Berkenholtz, who you mentioned has been on the show before. And this is called Swastani, the Goddess of One's Own Place. And she's recently published a book with Oxford called Reciting the Goddess on this same goddess in her tradition. So for our book, she translated the very oldest version of this story, which was written in Sanskrit. Most of the versions that came later were written in Newari. And then nowadays, most people are accessing it through Nepali. But the oldest one is a 500-year-old manuscript in Sanskrit. So it's fairly concise, and it tells the story of the goddess Swastani and the secret pledge that devotees can perform to honor her, and the various blessings that she gives to people that perform the vow or the pledge, the vrata. Swastani is a goddess that millions of Hindus in Nepal cherish. So she's not forgotten in the sense that people on the ground in Nepal don't know about her. Everyone knows about Swastani. But, you know, there's interesting ways that she is forgotten in a larger context. You would never hear about Swastani in a textbook about Hinduism, for example. And also even within her tradition in Nepal, the text has grown over the last five centuries into this virtual local Purana. And, you know, Berkenholtz points out that most of the material in this expanded Swastani text is dedicated to male gods and not to Swastani herself. So it's almost like she's been displaced within her own textual tradition just because of the way the text grew over time.
Well, it's an interesting point you make in that, you know, this idea of forgotten. She's certainly not forgotten by the people who worship her. But, you know, take myself as an example. I study Indian goddess traditions, and until Jessica's paper at Madison a few years ago on this goddess, I had never heard of her, you know?
Yeah, right.
But maybe it's just my own ignorance, but for Jessica's work, I think that would apply to a number of us, I imagine.
Yeah. And I mean, Nepalese Hindu traditions tend to be off the radar of scholars that don't work directly in Nepal. So, you know, it's understandable, but I think it doesn't have to be this way. I think it's just as fitting as a way to introduce general readers to Hindu goddess traditions as it is to start with more mainstream text and goddesses.
Sure. Maybe let's move on to Jeremy Saul's paper.
Yeah, so this is chapter 6, Kaila Devi, the great goddess's local avatar of miracles. And Kaila Devi's a goddess from Rajasthan. And this is one of two stories in the book, this chapter and the next, which are both translated on the basis of basically little pilgrims booklets that are available in the market stalls around their temples in Rajasthan and Gujarat. So it's a different sort of source. These are modern sources, perhaps based on some older stories that were passed down orally. But you know, these are targeted to people that are coming in recent times to the temple and basically telling the backstory about each of the goddesses. So it can be a refreshing change of pace to switch to a more modern type of narrative. With Kaila Devi, we get this very, very brief mention of her fighting demons. You know, this is kind of the requisite backstory. But really, the vast majority of the tale is about all the miracles that she performs and her interactions with yogis and babas and, you know, various people in the local area. Specific sites are mentioned, specific dates are given, which is something we don't see in older texts, which tend to be sort of delinked from place and time. So everyday practices like deity possession, animal sacrifice also play a role here. And so, I'm focusing on the narratives themselves, but the essays often also like flesh out more context about them. In this case, Jeremy Saul's essay talks, among other things, about the politics of animal sacrifice at Kaila Devi Shrine. It's absolutely forbidden nowadays, basically presented as something that would have never happened, but it still does happen kind of on the fringes of the village, in the dark of night. So it's something that probably in the past happened much more frequently, and it is mentioned in the narrative, but nowadays it's been cleansed in a sense. It's, you know, people are less comfortable with blood offerings, and so this is being downplayed.
Yeah, this fascinating snippet, even from, you know, when sort of the goddess was dipping her toe into the Brahmanic tradition through the Devi Mahatmya. I mean, this is her first appearance, mm-hmm. and yet you have this very evocative mention in chapter 13, the end frame, where the merchant and the king offer her, with flowers and incense and water and the blood of their own limbs. It's evocative, right? It's there's obviously more going on in the world behind the text that the text isn't particularly forthcoming about, it seems.
Right.
It's fascinating. How about the next paper?
Yeah, on Bahucharamata from Gujarat, subtitle She Who Roams Widely. So we're kind of glossing the literal meaning of her name, Bahuchara. So this is a goddess who, it's an interesting story in terms of how identity shifts over time, because this is a goddess that originally was most closely affiliated with non-elite groups, such as the transgender Hidras or Pavayas, as they call them in Gujarat, and various other non-elite groups. There was a Muslim community. There is a Muslim community associated with her temple, the Kamalias, who are also devotees of the goddess. But all of this has changed as she's shot to popularity in the last several decades, especially. But I'm sure this was going on for longer than that. So you get people coming from all over India. We have big names like Narendra Modi coming and paying homage to Bahuchara. So she's really central to just about everyone in Gujarat. And so this rise to popularity has led to her story being, again, kind of whitewashed. The specifics of her ties with the transgender community is really downplayed. Only at the very end of the story that we translated is this affiliation with transgender subjects brought up. And it's brought up in this way that basically is saying that unmanly men can go bathe in this lake nearby and achieve true manliness. So it's this very kind of heteronormative view, even though it involves a shifting of gender identities. It's sort of, they can cure their homosexuality or their transgender identity by bathing in the temple. So this is in sharp contrast to the other sort of narratives about Bahuchara, which Derry Dinell lays out in the essay portion. So these other narratives talk about a more radical understanding of femininity that comes out of these non-elite groups. So one of the stories talks about the goddess cutting off her own breast to avoid being raped. Another one has her castrate the would-be rapist. So, very graphic things that were edited out. They were downplayed in the story that's presented to pilgrims in more recent times.
So essentially, the text literally says, unmanly men can go jump in a lake.
Yeah, and they can become manly again.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the next paper.
Sure. Rashtrasena, the hawk goddess of the Mewar Mountains. So this one is also from Rajasthan, southern Rajasthan. And so this is a goddess that appears in two forms. She either appears under the name Rashtrasena, literally meaning something like army of the kingdom, and this is a human-like form, or a slightly different name, Rashtrasena, or the royal lady hawk, who plays the same role as protectress of the kingdom, with her temple located atop a hill near Udaipur that is very militarily strategic. It's like, an outpost that you can see bird's eye view, 360 degrees, so she takes the form of a female hawk under that name. So let's see. Yeah, the essay itself unpacks different linkages between this animal hybrid goddess and the Bill tribe. Theorizes that it possibly she came about. She was incorporated into the local pantheon from the Bill tribe in order to form an alliance with them because they were often rebelling against the local kingdom. But also traces these connections with other animal hybrid goddesses going back to the original Skanda Purana and even earlier. I think there's some mentions in the Mahabharata of these sorts of maters or mothers that have animal features that are sort of the genre from which Rasta Shiena arises. Okay, so
that brings us to part three.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, tantras and magic.
And it's probably useful to state, as you do, that we'll need to state this for the rest of time in the English-speaking world, especially, that while tantra is often equated with black magic and or ritualized sex, it's much more than that. There may be elements of black magic and or ritualized sex in tantra, but there's much more than that, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. The stories in this book that we've selected do have these sorts of dimensions of sexuality and magic. But at the same time, you know, I wrote a whole book on a tantric medical tradition that really has practically no connection to sexuality at all. So, the tantras were a very broad category, and only certain subsets of them had affiliations with magic and sexuality. But, these themes make for good stories. And so we've selected some stories that tell really interesting tales that involve these themes. Okay, so chapter 9 is on Rungda from Bali. This is a translation of the Calung Arang. This is a story from medieval Indonesia, written in old Javanese, translated by Tom Hunter and Ari Wayan. And so this is a great reminder that Hinduism is not limited to South Asia. It has a much broader reach, especially in Southeast Asia, but in other parts of Asia as well. So yeah, I would have liked to include more sources like this on Hinduism in Japan, for example, Hinduism in Central Asia, the various ways that the influence spread. But so this story is an exciting narrative about a witch who calls down a gruesome epidemic. So this is kind of timely for our current pandemic situation. But this witch named Rungda, she is a widow and her daughter has been mistreated by other people in the kingdom. And so she prays to Durga using these tantric sort of black magic practices. At least that's how it's perceived. That's how she perceives it. To call down an epidemic on the whole kingdom. And so Durga's kind of like, well, this isn't such a good idea, but you know, okay, I'll let you do this. We'll see how it turns out. So some very gruesome descriptions of the deaths that happen from this epidemic that's spreading. But you know, essentially it's all resolved in the end, spoiler alert, but, a semi-divine sage intervenes, Durga herself gets involved, and the tension of the story is brought to a close at the end. Basically, they realize that the tantric text that the witch was using to cause all of this trouble, actually she was misinterpreting it, that it wasn't a book about black magic, it was actually instructions on how to achieve spiritual liberation, but she was putting it to an unintended use. So that's a theme we often see with the tantras, that that ultimately it's about liberation, but people put it to, that people misuse it in various ways.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Well, maybe many a person on some sort of tantric retreat in the West will end up being liberated unintentionally. and the next paper by one Michael Sluber.
Okay, myself, Michael Sluber. This is a story that I've been working on, had started to work on about 12 years ago, and I was actually going to publish a translation of it, the same translation. I revised it, of course, but I was going to publish it 12 years ago in a different colleague's collection of translated sources on Tantra. That never came to pass. It never came to fruition. So I've just sort of taken it and made the book happen on my own vision of the book. Yeah, when I was originally working on this, I suspected that there was some kind of connection between the goddess that the story is about, Twarita, and this royal goddess of Nepal named Taleju. This is the same goddess that is thought to possess the virgin girls in the famous Nepalese Kumari tradition. And so I suspected that there was the connection there because one day when I was living in Kathmandu, I lived there for about a year, and I was walking on the banks of the Bagmati River, and I came across this inscription. I took a photograph of it. It didn't look like a particularly old inscription, but anyway, it said Tulaja Kumari Devi. So there was that name Tulaja, which in Maharashtra is used to refer to the goddess Twarita. So there was some connection there. This planted the seed in my mind that there's a connection between this goddess from this, you know, 800, 900 year old text that I had found in the archives and this modern Kumari tradition in Nepal that's centrally important to the erstwhile royal family. So the story itself is very interesting. It doesn't make connections to Nepal, so it must have originated further back in time. But in the essay, I basically trace that the goddess and this story were brought into Nepal in sometime between the 11th and the 13th century, and that she was adapted into this new royal goddess, Taleju. I could tell you a little bit about the story itself, too, if we have time. I don't want to talk too much
about it. Sure, we have. Well, first of all, it's your job to talk more than me. So we do have time, and you are probably a typical self-effacing scholar. And don't worry, you're not promoting yourself. It's me promoting you. I'm doing the promoting. I'll take the heat. Please okay. tell us about the article.
Okay, so the story itself tells about Shiva participating in some sort of secretive ritual with a group of yoginis. What exactly was intended to happen in this ritual is not clear. The story doesn't give any specifics, but it mentions a few euphemistic terms like charu, which normally means rice pudding, you know, some kind of benign thing that would be offered in a ritual. But here, it certainly means something different. And so basically my conclusion is that this either means something sexual or it's some kind of reckless self-sacrifice that Shiva would have been offering his own flesh and blood for the yoginis to eat. And so in either case, however we interpret these euphemistic words, Parvati gets very upset when she hears that Shiva is involved in this ritual. And so she generates herself as Twarita, this goddess that, you know, blinds everyone with her light and frightens the whole universe and basically is threatening to destroy everything until she can be pacified by the various other gods that praise all her qualities. So lots of interesting themes going on in this story and linkages to royal patrons. So it's just subtle hints, but we get the sense that the authors of this story were trying to appeal to royal patrons that if you get this goddess on your side, you can use her to fight enemy kingdoms. And so, yeah, this is a sort of genre of goddesses as protectors of royal lineages that Bihani Sarkar has written about in a book just a couple in the last year or two.
Heroic Shaktism, I believe.
Right. Yeah. Heroic Shaktism. Thank you.
Great. Fantastic.
So yeah, evidently that attempt to market Twarita to a royal audience worked in the case of Nepal because she seems to have been adapted as the royal goddess there.
It's so fascinating. There's just so many themes at play in these various narratives that overlap and differ from one another all at the same time. So there are two more narratives. Next we go to the lovely Kameshwari.
Right.
What's going on there?
So-called goddess of desire. So this is a direct translation from a tantric ritual text, which several different ritual texts that are describing how a tantric practitioner should visualize Kameshwari. So it uses heavily erotic imagery. The oldest of the sources is called the Nitya Kaula, and this comes from the earliest phase that we know of about the goddess Kameshwari, before she was identified with Tripura Sundari, before she was identified with Parvati Shiva and all of that. She seems to have been presented as the consort of Kamadeva in this cult to Kamadeva, which has since died out. So all of the only evidence for this cult survives in this one damaged manuscript of the Nitya Kaula from Nepal, which is something like 800 or 900 years old. So two of the passages, short passages that are translated, is based on that. Like I said, heavily erotic imagery, lots of use of the color red and sexual kind of imagery of how we imagine the goddess. So the other passages are from slightly later stages, from texts from the 10th, 11th century that then do link her with Tripura Sundari and the whole Sri Vidya tradition. And so, it's this complicated development that we see in her identity. So heavily visual, because it's a meditation guide.
And the final entry.
Mm-hmm. Avyapadesha, or indefinable Kali. So this is a form of Kali which probably nobody has heard of before, because this is a text that almost nobody has worked on. A centrally important goddess text from the first millennium, it's over 1,000 years old, called the Jayadratha Yamala. And the translator of this chapter, Olga Surbayeva, is pretty much the only person in the world that is working on the Jayadratha Yamala. And this is this massive text of about 24,000 verses, and it details over 100 different forms of Kali, and describes how she should be worshipped and how she should be visualized. So, it's this very strange situation where we have these really, really important early texts on goddesses, but hardly anyone is paying attention to them. So this is one of the most important chapters in the book in the sense of conveying these texts that are essential for the history of Hindu goddess worship, but almost nobody is reading, because they're not available in editions. They're only available in manuscripts. So the chapter itself, the narrative itself, is basically this mystical presentation of the goddess as being beyond words. So it goes through a long list of different tantric cults and religious perspectives, philosophical principles. In every case, it says the goddess is not this, not this. So, obviously this harkens back to the Upanishads and this neti-neti device of saying the Brahman is not this and not this. But this takes it to another level of sophistication. This is influenced by the Krama tantric tradition, which sees the goddess, or a series of goddesses, as the cyclical pulsing of awareness. So these aren't, goddesses that are meant to be worshipped in temples. These are the true manifestations of the awareness of all living beings. And so, it's just an utterly fascinating passage, probably unique worldwide. There are there's certainly traditions in European history, mystical traditions called the Via Negativa, which do a similar thing. They say God is not this, and God is not that, and God is not that. Never about a goddess. So this might be the only source in the history of humanity that that applies this way of thinking to a goddess.
It's you read it. It's if assuming one has any sort of sensibility for poetry or the beyond, she is neither primordial matter nor spirit, nor the limited knowledge found in the scriptures. She's not time nor limited agency, nor the limited view of causation, nor that passion that derives from karmic necessity. She is neither illusion nor the great illusion called pure knowledge. She is not Ishwara and not Sadashiva and not Shakti and not Shiva. I mean, it's beyond, right? Like,
and it even says at one point she's not Kali. So, even us calling her Kali is a little bit misleading, because the text is asserting that any category that humans can come up with, any kind of verbal category, is just a construct, that that the goddess is something beyond what we can conceive, and that we have to, it's in some sense, just leave it at that.
And at least in terms of this anthology, Kali is both the alpha and the omega, it seems, and that you start off with a form of Kali and you end with one. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that was intentional, but it's you know, for someone who enjoys studying frame narratives, those sorts of things come to mind. Great. I mean, there's so much there. There is a plethora of regional linguistic material here. I mean, what folks who don't study South Asia don't realize is that there's quite literally demonstrably more diversity in South Asia than all of Europe, easily.
Oh, absolutely.
Without question. And it's so rich.
I mean, even still, I tell my students this in every class, there's something like 1,500 living languages in India. So and in the past, it was even more. So it's just incredibly diverse, like so many different cultures, so many different people brought together. So there's just these rich traditions of goddess stories and goddess practices that I think people deserve to know about. I mean, of course, there's scholarship out there on all of this, on most of this, but it's often written for a more educated audience, or it's single books about particular traditions. So you can get Rachel Fell McDermott singing to the goddess, these wonderful translations of devotional poems from Bengal, but that's a single goddess and it's a single region. So I wanted to bring together all of this diversity. Well, not all of it, but sort of capture a selection of it in order to make this available to students and general readers.
Oh, it's certainly a welcome addition to the library of specialists, generalists, people interested in the goddess. And the timing is good for this. We didn't plan it this way, but the Navaratri festival is coming up.
Oh, yes.
So it should be interesting to learn about different goddesses or different forms of the goddess. The last question I'd like to ask you, you can feel free to answer in an armchair capacity or from your expertise or from the anthology, but one or many, you say something very insightful in your preface that I think many of us have internalized. We may or may not have articulated it. And many people who study Hinduism in a comparative lens, becomes a snag, this whole monotheism versus polytheism. And this insight you share, I can't remember how you phrase it exactly, but it's along the lines of, in Hinduism, things can be polytheistic and monotheistic. And there's not really a sense of, there's not a need to reconcile that in the same way. And if I'm putting words in your mouth, by all means, correct me. But what would you say about this idea of, well, are these examples of forms of the goddess, or are these multiple variegated different goddesses?
Right. So it's a complex question. It depends on who you're asking. So, I mean, if you're asking me, certainly I regard when a goddess has a different name, I tend to regard them as a different identity. Typically that's associated with different appearances. And so, I think that the differences do matter. I don't think we can just roll it all together and say it's all one thing. It is one. I mean, so many of the texts present all the goddesses as ultimately a single Shakti. So, that's very clear in several of the sources. But at the same time, I don't think that we can just ignore the differences either that show up in all these different manifestations. So it's a matter of perspective, and if you're looking at it from an insider or an outsider perspective. But I think the point that I was making in the introduction that you were calling attention to is that many people come to study Hinduism thinking that, with this lens of either or, it's one thing or it's another. It's either monotheistic or polytheistic, and it has to be one or the other. But Hinduism is wonderful for that, going beyond these diametrical opposites, this sort of binary of this or that. It says no, the goddess can be both this and that. She can be both one and many. So this is what we're seeing in many of the sources. In the source on the indefinable Kali, for example, it's pointing out very heavily that conceptual categories are not going to do it, that the divine, it goes beyond what we can imagine.
There can be no better note to end on than that, I imagine. Okay. I hope this was as fun for me as it was for you. Great. So for those of you out there listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Michael Sluber, who's the editor of a really exciting new anthology of goddess narratives. It's called A Garland of Forgotten Goddesses, Tales of the Feminine Divine from India and Beyond, University of California Press 2020. Comes out in a couple months. The links are in the podcast description. Thank you very much for appearing on the program today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, likewise. Until next time, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the many faces of the goddess.